welcome to the Fiorella Files. I'm your hostess, Fiorella Nash, sometimes known by my nom de plume, Fiorella de Maria. I'm a writer of crime fiction and historical novels and an incorrigible bibliophile. It's wonderful to be making a programme on pretty much my favourite subject, books. On my show, I will be introducing you to books, classic and contemporary, that you must read, should enjoy reading, or should not touch with an 11-foot barge pole. Once a month, I will also be doing my special edition children's book show involving younger reviewers talking about and sharing their favourite books. It's Christmas time, everyone. It is very, very nearly Christmas, and it couldn't come a day too soon. In honour of this wonderful Christian festival, I am going to treat you to three works of literature very closely connected with Christmas and the celebration of Christmas. I really struggled to find just three because there are so many beautiful books from right across the centuries dealing with Christmas and families coming together for Christmas and the real meaning of Christmas. But I hope you will enjoy the three I have chosen for you today. For my non-fiction choice, for the first time on this show, I am going to be sharing a collection of poetry by pretty close to my favourite poet and my favourite saint ever, Saint Robert Southwell, or Southwell, depending on which part of the country you're from. Saint Robert Southwell, S.J. Now, before I read to you, because I will read some of his poems, because I think that's the best way to explain and explore poetry. Before I read some of his Christmas poems to you, let me tell you a thing or two about this wonderful, wonderful Jesuit martyr. And in fact, I'd like to tell you a bit about how I first became acquainted with him, because I really love this man, so much so that on my wedding day, my husband of about an hour, said in his wedding speech that he felt he was fighting for my attention with a string of dead poets, including Robert Southwell. The feelings are entirely platonic, I might add, when it comes to poets, I assure you. But here's how I met Robert Southwell. I was studying English in a university that, shall we say, isn't entirely friendly to Catholics. I think if you want slightly more Catholic-friendly studies, you probably go to Oxford. Cambridge, a little bit less so. And I was studying the Renaissance and its wall-to-wall anti-Catholic polemics. And I'd sit in lectures seething because nobody even commented on the fact that the texts were incredibly anti-Catholic. If we were studying a text that was very anti-Semitic, you know, the lecturer would be really justifiably quite apologetic about it and say, OK, I realise some of the expressions being used here are a bit difficult to stomach these days, but please try to get into the context and all of the rest, and very much distance themselves from the open hatred that you get in some of these texts. But anti-Catholic texts, who cares? So they're describing priests as vermin to be hunted down and Catholics as monstrous traitors. That's fine. No one worry themselves, please, about my feelings. And in the midst of this, I was looking for a poet to study for a dissertation. And I was walking along the library through the Renaissance section, and I saw the initials S.J. on the jacket of a book, you know, on the spine of a book. And I thought, S.J.? Society of Jesus? Oh, please, let this be true. And there it was. The Poetry of Robert Southwell, S.J. And I took it off the shelf, and that was it. By the end of the afternoon, I'd read all his poems, and I thought he was the most fantastic poet ever. Give you a little bit of biographical detail. Robert Southwell grew up in the ruins of Britain's Catholic heritage. He was from a very wealthy family who had been made wealthy on land stolen from the church during the Henrician Reformation, during the dissolution of the monasteries. So he would have grown up surrounded by imagery of England's Catholic past, the ruins of that priory. But he was very much not a retro Catholic. He grew up very aware of the abuses in the church and the corruption and all the things that had led to the Reformation, and he wanted to give his life as a priest to the new evangelization of the time. This was the post-Council of Trent world. A lot of enthusiasm, big outpouring of spirituality and piety, and terrible persecution of Catholics in Britain. So when Robert Southwell slipped away abroad to study for the priesthood, he knew if he ever returned that he would certainly be put to death. He would be tortured and he would be executed in the most brutal fashion before a baying crowd. He knew the terrible risks he was taking. And thanks to his opportunity to study abroad, he really came across the international side of the Catholic faith for the first time. He would have seen the first Japanese Catholics when they arrived in Rome. Incredible moment in the history of the church and in the history of Europe. The beginnings of Christianity becoming truly global. So he would have had a very, very interesting cultural experience of the faith. And he went on the English mission and he spent 6 years going from safe house to safe house, saying mass in secret, hiding in priest holes, and extraordinarily writing poetry on the run. How on earth he could put his mind to writing verse, it's anybody's guess how he actually had the creative energy to do that whilst trying not to get killed. His poems were so popular that they went through more editions than Sidney and Spencer, who were the two foremost English poets of the time. And they were so ecumenical, even though they have very strong Christian and Catholic themes, that the Bishop of London, the Protestant Bishop of London, gave the book permission to be published. You had to have permission to publish a book at the time. There was no freedom of the press. And he didn't actually realise that the poet was a Catholic priest. When Robert Southwell was betrayed and imprisoned, he went through 3 years of horrific suffering. And when he was finally executed, crowds gathered because he was, in fact, very famous as a result of his poetry. And they were so moved by his words at the scaffold that when the rope was placed around his neck and the cart moved away, a crowd surged onto the platform and swung on his body to make sure he died quickly. It was actually a mercy. That may sound like a weird way of showing your appreciation to someone, but if people didn't want a condemned man to suffer, that was what they did. And when they held up his head and said, "Behold the head of a traitor," instead of cheering, there was just this long silence. So he was an extraordinary man, extraordinary priest and martyr, and one of the great martyrs, I feel, of the English church. So, as you can tell, I really like this man, and I am so happy that there is a relatively recent collection of his poems available. Until the early noughties, until this collection of poetry came out, in fact, and I think it was 2007, there had been nothing pretty much published of his since the 1950s. So this is great. Tragically, the academic Anne Sweeney, who produced a lot of work on Robert Southwell's writings and a collection of essays and edited his work, died very young of cancer, so was not able to produce as much material as I think she very much wanted to. That was a very tragic loss for academia, but she did leave behind some really excellent work. And I'm going now to read a couple of Robert Southwell's Christmas poems. When I'm reading them, think persecution. Think Catholics, recusants as they were called, huddled up in their safe houses, hearing mass in secret, living in constant fear, facing ruin from fines and imprisonment and torture and possibly execution for their beliefs. Think of what it must have been like to live like that. And be thinking of that when you hear his poems, because so much of his poetry about the Nativity and about the child Jesus draws attention to the fragility of the baby, the fact that God becomes man as a tiny, vulnerable, poor child. It's the poverty and the threat that surrounds the Holy Family that really comes out in Robert Southwell's poetry, the pain, the foreshadowing of Calvary, the agony in the garden, the passion. So be thinking about all of these things while I'm reading. The Burning Babe by Robert Southwell. As I, in hoary winter's night, stood shivering in the snow, surprised I was with sudden heat, which made my heart to glow. And lifting up a fearful eye to view what fire was near, a pretty babe all burning bright did in the air appear, who scorched with excessive heat, such floods of tears did shed, as though his floods should quench his flames, which with his tears were fed. Alas, quoth he, but newly born in fiery heats I fry, yet none approach to warm their hearts, or feel my fire but I. My faultless breast the furnace is, the fuel wounding thorns. Love is the fire, and sighs the smoke, the ashes, shame and scorns. The fuel justice layeth on, and mercy blows the coals. The metal in this furnace wrought are men's defiled souls, for which as now on fire I am to work them to their good, so will I melt into a bath to wash them in my blood. With this he vanished out of sight, and swiftly shrunk away, and straight I called unto mind that it was Christmas Day. How about that? The first metaphysical poem in the English language. You heard it here. This poem, entitled New Heaven, New War, forms the basis of one of the songs from Benjamin Britten's Ceremony of Carols. If you've never heard Britten's Ceremony of Carols, please do look it up. I'm sure it's available on YouTube or Spotify or whatever. It's very, very popular over here. And in fact, Benjamin Britten used this poem and another poem as two of the reflections, and it makes for a very, very beautiful suite of carols. But here we go. Again, think contrasts, think majesty in a manger, and all the implications for an impoverished Christian community. Come to your heaven, you heavenly choirs. Earth hath the heaven of your desires. Remove your dwelling to your God. A stall is now his best abode. Sith men their homage do deny, come angels all their faults supply. His chilling cold doth heat require. Come seraphims in lieu of fire. This little ark no cover hath, yet cherubs' wings his body swathe. Come, Raphael, this babe must eat, provide our little Toby meat. Let Gabriel be now his groom that first took up his earthly room. Let Michael stand in his defence, whom love hath linked to feeble sense. Let graces rock when he doth cry, and angels sing his lullaby. The same you saw in heavenly seat is he that now sucks Mary's teat. Agnize your king, a mortal wight, his borrowed weed lets not your sight. Come, kiss the manger where he lies, that is your bliss above the skies. This little babe, so few days old, is come to rifle Satan's fold. All hell doth at his presence quake, though he himself for cold do shake. For in this weak unarmoured wise, the gates of hell he will surprise. With tears he fights and wins the field, his naked breast stands for a shield, his battering shot a babish cries, his arrows looks of weeping eyes, his martial ensigns cold and need, and feeble flesh his warrior's steed. His camp is pictured in a stall, his bulwark but a broken wall, the crib his trench, haystalks his stakes, of shepherds he his muster makes, and thus as sure his foe to wound, the angel's trumps alarum sound. My soul with Christ join thou in fight, stick to the tents that he hath pight, within his crib is surest ward. This little babe will be thy guard. If thou wilt foil thy foes with joy, then flit not from this heavenly boy.
You've probably worked out that I do really think this poet is worth learning more about. He's been very neglected because tastes come and go. He was very, very popular as a poet even after his death, right up until the English Civil War, when Puritanism took over and he fell out of favour. But I think he is a great literary secret, and I think the secret needs to come out. So please do look up the collected poems of Robert Southwell. And let me know what you think of them. Write to me at fiorella@crusadechannel.com. I always like to hear from you. We will return in just a moment and take a stroll through our library's fiction section, next on the Fiorella Files, here on the Crusade Channel. It's not just talk, it's radio. Files. And next, our library tour leads us forward about 250 years to the mid-19th century and the writer who probably epitomises Victorian England, particularly Victorian London, more than any other, Mr. Charles Dickens. I have to admit, I was absolutely in a sweat about reviewing A Christmas Carol, because I had a sudden panic when I sat at the microphone that I might have done it before. This is partly because I have, in fact, reviewed Dickens previously, Nicholas Nickleby in particular, and I've talked about A Christmas Carol in front of so many audiences that it gets quite difficult sometimes to remember exactly whom you have spoken to about a particular subject. It's like when you repeat yourself in conversation. And the reason I talk a lot about A Christmas Carol is that I think it is incredibly important when it comes to our understanding of how to influence society through fiction. Now, we all know A Christmas Carol. It's been adapted so many times in film, on the stage, in cartoon animations. I grew up with Mickey's Christmas Carol with Donald Duck as Ebenezer Scrooge. You know, it wasn't bad. And the children faithfully watch A Muppet's Christmas Carol every year, and I'm sure that they think that Charles Dickens really did look like the great Gonzo. But, you know, I think A Muppet's Christmas Carol captures the spirit of the story about as well as a children's adaptation can. And Sir Michael Caine is clearly having the time of his life acting with a whole lot of Muppets. So it's a story we all kind of feel we know. The name Ebenezer Scrooge is synonymous with miserliness and hatred of Christmas. You can now get Christmas jumpers and Christmas hats, you know, Santa hats, with Bah Humbug all over them. The expression Bah Humbug gets used all the time. And I found it quite funny that Boris Johnson, when talking about how he wanted to make sure we get a Christmas this year because it's been a bit of a lousy year, he said he didn't want to cancel Christmas, as it were, because he didn't want to be known as Scrooge. Because he knew if he said, no, families can't meet together for Christmas because of COVID, he'd end up all over the papers. Boris Scrooge steals Christmas from us. So it's very familiar. A lot of the references come up in daily life, in the way we talk. God bless us, everyone, without us even thinking about it. There has even been, in fact, a film made of the writing of A Christmas Carol. A rather nice film, in fact, called The Man Who Invented Christmas. It's a bit of a sentimentalised version of Dickens, very different to the previously made film, whose name escapes me, starring Ralph Fiennes as an adulterous Dickens having an affair with a young actress. Let's face it, I don't think he was a very nice man. But The Man Who Invented Christmas really does give quite a good idea of how influential A Christmas Carol was when it came out. And certainly our whole image of Christmas and the Victorian Christmas has been hugely influenced by A Christmas Carol. It's not for nothing that Dickens is referred to as the man who invented Christmas, because at the time of writing, a lot of traditions like the Christmas tree, which was brought over by Prince Albert from Germany, was just starting to become popular, and the use of Christmas carols, the singing of particular carols that we still sing today, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen and all the rest, it was just starting to become popular, and Dickens really solidified that image, cemented that image of Christmas in the public consciousness. So it has been hugely influential. I'm going to say this while my children aren't in the room. When my son Nicholas was 2 years old, he broke his leg. He decided it would be interesting to see what happens if you jump sideways off the top of a slide. And that is what happens, in fact, a broken femur. And when he came out of the hospital in a plaster cast, everyone was saying he looked like Tiny Tim. Because again, we have this image of the poor little boy with the little wooden crutch, and it tugs at the heartstrings, and it still does. So A Christmas Carol, I hardly need to tell you the story. Ebenezer Scrooge, the horrible miser, is visited by his old dead business partner Marley and warned that he will be visited by three ghosts: the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas yet to come. You could almost say with the ghost of Christmas past that Scrooge is being given a kind of cognitive behavioural therapy session, going back deep into his past to work out what on earth went wrong. And quite a lot went wrong, it turns out. Dickens described the book as a ghost story. And the funny thing is, even though it is obviously a ghost story because four different ghosts appear in the course of the book, one doesn't tend to think of it as a ghost story because we focus so much on the person of Scrooge and the things he sees and experiences and the huge conversion he goes through. There's been a huge amount of debate among critics about whether the image of Christmas that Dickens gives in A Christmas Carol is a kind of secular vision of Christmas as a happy holiday, which is terribly good for everyone and brings families together and all this tripe we know is not in fact true, because we still hear it today, or whether it is in fact a Christian allegory about redemption and atonement and the call to conversion. I prefer to take the latter view. But I am aware that there is an uneasiness about the way Dickens describes Christmas, and certainly his own views on religion and particularly Christianity were complex. What is commented upon a lot less about the book, and this is what I tend to talk about a lot, is the timing of the book. December 1843. The timing is significant because it was around that time that reforms were made to the poor laws, which made them even harsher against the poor. Very influenced by Malthus, the poor laws were made so difficult, so harsh, that it was almost impossible for the poor to get help. They could only get aid if they went to the workhouses. And that is why the workhouses feature in A Christmas Carol, where you have the two philanthropists saying, "Many would rather die than go to the workhouse." Dickens talks about the workhouses a lot in his books, but it really comes up in a very forceful way in A Christmas Carol. He was drawing attention to the fact that the poor were being forced to go to the harshest, nastiest place in the country, the workhouse, for help. And it had been made so horrendous that a young man starving on the streets would rather die in the gutter than enter the workhouse. It was that bad. He was also criticising Malthusian theory. As bad ideas go, the completely false theory of Malthus has to be one of the worst in terms of the terrible harm it has done, the way it has fixed itself in the public consciousness for now several hundred years, that the world cannot sustain itself, that the population is growing faster than food production can grow, and that therefore we can't feed our people. We will reach a point where we can't feed the population and everyone will starve. This is a very common idea, taken up again in the 1970s by the Ehrlichs, Paul and Anne Ehrlich. And what made this theory so attractive, and still is attractive to people, particularly in the West, I go on about this at length in my book, The Abolition of Woman, is that Malthusian theory blames the poor for their own misfortune. It's their fault because they are too many. It's their fault because they breed like rabbits. And I don't think many people realise quite how terrible the ideas Malthus put forward were, that we should not have hospitals to look after the sick, that we should not offer the poor any relief whatsoever. That is what Dickens so brutally satirises in A Christmas Carol, when Scrooge turns on the philanthropists and says, if the poor are going to die, they'd better go and do it, and decrease the surplus population. It's an incredibly powerful moment. Dickens was slapping society across the face with its own prejudices. It was saying to society, you are killing Tiny Tim. You are, because you are supporting policies that are making it impossible for the poor to survive. You are responsible for this, not the poor. The well-heeled Londoners with their warm houses and their servants and the food on the table. Victorian London was an incredibly wasteful place. The amount of food that was thrown away in London at the time Dickens was writing could have fed 1,000 people. And Dickens knew all this. So he was really pointing a finger of accusation at his own readers. It's not the poor's fault, it's yours. And by creating the admittedly rather sentimental figure of Tiny Tim, who tugs on the heartstrings, the sweet, sickly little boy, the crippled boy, who is doomed to die, he was giving a face to the impoverished children of England. He wasn't just talking about the poor. He was talking about this poor little family, this hard-working, noble, decent family, the Cratchit family, and this poor little boy. It's incredibly powerful as a social comment. And it's interesting because A Christmas Carol has just become part of the background to Christmas entertainment. And it's easy to forget how radical it actually was and is. Because there is still a lot of waste. There is still a lot of poverty. A terrible statistic came out some years ago that said that, it was a study in fact, that said that the gap between rich and poor in Britain today is as large as it was in Victorian times, but there's a lot less philanthropy than there was before. Because in Victorian times, largely as a result of books like A Christmas Carol, which encouraged people to give to the poor, there was a lot of good work. You had people like Dr. Barnardo, or Dickens himself, writing about the workhouses. You had well-to-do women working in soup kitchens, trying to make sure that the homeless got something to eat. You know, there was a lot going on. Now, I'm not saying that the poor in today's Britain are as poor as the poor people of Victorian England, because that's not true. We have a welfare state, we have council housing, we have a benefits system, even though it's not perfect. But it's interesting seeing the differences in terms of the way we perceive charity and the duty to give to charity. So this is an enduringly relevant book. It's entertaining. It's just a beautiful read at Christmas time. It's the sort of book you imagine sitting in your armchair before a roaring fire reading to your children. But it's also a book with a devastating message. I'm going to read a passage from A Christmas Carol. I should have done that first, of course, but then I did read some poems before, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Marley was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. Mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade. But the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hands shall not disturb it, or the country's done for. You will therefore permit me to repeat emphatically that Marley was as dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead? Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole administrator, his sole assign, his sole residuary legatee, his sole friend and sole mourner. And even Scrooge was not so dreadfully cut up by the sad event, but that he was an excellent man of business on the very day of the funeral, and solemnised it with an undoubted bargain. The mention of Marley's funeral brings me back to the point I started from. There is no doubt that Marley was dead. This must be distinctly understood, or nothing wonderful can come of the story I'm going to relate. If we were not perfectly convinced that Hamlet's father died before the play began, there would be nothing more remarkable than his taking a stroll at night, in an easterly wind, upon his own ramparts, than there would be in any other middle-aged gentleman rashly turning out after dark in a breezy spot, say St. Paul's Churchyard, for instance, literally to astonish his son's weak mind. Scrooge never painted out old Marley's name. There it stood, years afterwards, above the warehouse door. Scrooge and Marley. The firm was known as Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge Scrooge, and sometimes Marley. But he answered to both names. It was all the same to him. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted, hand-at-the-grindstone Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained, and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shrivelled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head and on his eyebrows and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days, and didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. External heat and cold had little influence on Scrooge. No warmth could warm, no wintry weather chill him. No wind that blew was bitterer than he, no falling snow was more intent upon its purpose, no pelting rain less open to entreaty. Foul weather didn't know where to have him. The heaviest rain and snow and hail and sleet could boast of the advantage over him in only one respect. They often came down handsomely, and Scrooge never did. Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say with gladsome looks, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to see me?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what it was o'clock. No man or woman ever once in all his life inquired the way to such and such a place of Scrooge. Even the blind men's dogs appeared to know him, and when they saw him coming on, would tug their owners into doorways and up courts, and then would wag their tails as though they said, "No eye at all is better than an evil eye, dark master." But what did Scrooge care? It was the very thing he liked, to edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance, was what the knowing ones call nuts to Scrooge. And from there the story begins, on that fateful Christmas Eve. It's funny, I can't read that opening anymore without thinking of the great Gonzo in a top hat, saying those words as dead as a doornail to Rizzo the Rat. This is bad. I shouldn't be thinking of the great Gonzo and various Muppets when I'm thinking of the great Charles Dickens. But anyway, there it is. There is, in fact, a musical version of A Christmas Carol called Scrooge with the great Albert Finney in the person of Scrooge. It didn't do terribly well when it was first produced. I think it's a very fine piece of entertainment. It's got Sir Alec Guinness as Jacob Marley, a rather camp Jacob Marley, to be honest, which doesn't quite fit with the character, but it's got some wonderful moments. So maybe give that one a try as well. That's Scrooge with Albert Finney. Anyway, moving on to our light, fluffy, contemporary Christmas novel. A detective novel, no less. I've been wanting to review the DC Ryan mysteries for quite a while. As you know, I like crime fiction, and this is yet another series I've got very familiar with over the last year. I've read probably three or four of the books to date, and they're passably good detective stories. DC Ryan is, he's an interesting enough character in his own right. He is a professional murder detective. Most contemporary crime fiction tends to be split between detectives who are in fact policemen and going about their official business, and the amateur detective like Agatha Raisin and all the rest who sort of do it for fun. So Ryan is an actual detective and he is surrounded by a team. It seems to me that the way police work is described is, well, it's plausible anyway. I get the impression the author has done some research. The only thing that is not at all plausible, as my husband keeps pointing out, is that in reality, a group of policemen, a team, would not deal with that many murders, or certainly not with that many murders that frequently. Most of the time, policemen are dealing with, you know, people thumping each other and petty theft and sadly domestic violence and things like that. There's quite a spread of crime, but Ryan is a murder detective. Sorry, I've done it again. It's DCI Ryan, not DC Ryan. So I'm always making that mistake. The books are by L.J. Ross. They are best-selling and award-winning, and there are lots of them. So if it's the sort of series you really take to, it could keep you busy for a very long time. They're near contemporary. They're all set between about 2010 and the present day. I got a bit put off with one of the first ones I read because one member of the team, Mackenzie, is an ex-Catholic. And of course it has to come up in the story because it always does. But in fact, it's quite a fleeting reference. She makes one snarky comment and that's the only comment I think she ever makes. So, you know, it's just about bearable. Just take a deep breath and get on. Ryan's Christmas is a cosy Christmas mystery. It's the classic situation. DCI Ryan and his wife, who's an academic, an archaeologist, and Detective Sergeant Phillips and Mackenzie, they're a married couple, have all gone to Edinburgh for the day to look at the Christmas markets. On the way back, they're caught in a terrible freak snowstorm and they pull up by an old castle that's supposed to be the most haunted castle in Britain, seeking refuge. And you can imagine, it is absolutely the classic Christmas detective story. They're in a country house, very isolated. The author has had to go to some lengths to create an incredibly isolated situation in Britain because we're quite a small country. You're never that far away from anywhere. But because there's been this freak snowstorm, the lines are down. There's no reception on mobile phones. So it is convincingly isolated. You've got a select group of guests and lo and behold, a murder. An apparently impossible murder. And because you've got the whole supernatural backdrop of all the ghosts who apparently wander the corridors, is it in fact one of the ghosts? Of course it isn't. Or is it one of the guests? And Ryan and his team have to find out who done it before the person who done it gets to them. I can't say I found it the most satisfying of murder mysteries. I did find it a very little bit too derivative. It feels very, very like an Agatha Christie I have read in terms of the way the plot develops and whodunit. And I'm sure the author must have read that particular Agatha Christie. I'm not going to say which one so as not to spoil the story, but it's so very much influenced by it that as soon as it becomes apparent what pattern it's falling, I found it quite obvious who's responsible. But you read it for the atmosphere, for the snow-covered grounds, for the old castle, for the drama between the different guests who are beautifully portrayed, the whining middle-aged woman, the rather silly, drunken young girl who really can't cope with social situations, the sad widow who's having a break away with her adult daughter to try to cope with her loss. You know, it's the human dynamic to the story that makes it interesting and makes it enjoyable. And it's very unusual now for there to be a classic country house mystery where all the occupants are completely disconnected from the rest of the world, because we live in a world of mobile phones and internet and all sorts of things. So Ross is to be commended for creating this situation, because it is just very enjoyable reading. And I think read it just to imagine yourself in a snowy world and a mysterious castle. Don't read it for the guessing game of trying to work out who done it. I think some of the other Ryan mysteries are much, much more interesting in terms of the actual mystery. The plot is much more tightly woven in, say, Longstone, for example. In that particular book, I didn't guess till the last minute who done it, and I usually do. I've picked this because it's a Christmas book, because it's a good Christmas read. But if you find you enjoy it and you take to the main characters who do keep cropping up in all the other books, then maybe give the whole series a try. So we've had the poetry of Robert Southwell, SJ. We've had A Christmas Carol and Ryan's Christmas. Three very, very different books for you to look at. Don't forget to write to me at fiorella@crusadechannel.com. Let me know what you make of the books. Give me your recommendations, particularly your seasonal recommendations. I'm always very interested in books that are connected with a particular part of the year. Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, whatever, the summer. There's lots of books about the summer. It has, as always, been my absolute pleasure to lead you on a journey through my eclectic and crazy library. I hope you have a truly blessed Christmas and a prosperous New Year. And we'll speak again in 2021, hopefully a happier year for all of us. And in the words of the wonderful Mother Teresa, it's not how much we give, but how much love we put into giving. Goodbye and God bless.